In today's episode, I'm happy to talk to Oliver Koch from the European Commission in Brussels. Together with Oliver, I'm discussing the European Commission's important role in energy market regulation. The Commission works to integrate national energy markets into European-wide markets, shapes the EU's energy landscape, and promotes a transition towards cleaner and more sustainable energy systems. Enjoy the conversation. I'm thrilled to have Oliver Koch today in this episode. Oliver Koch works as Deputy Head of Unit in the Legal Unit of the Commission's Directorate General for Energy. He leads the team in charge of developing and drafting new energy legislation and oversees legislative negotiations with the Council and the Parliament. His team also deals with the enforcement of EU rules vis-a-vis member states and also the defense of energy law cases before EU courts and international arbitration panels. I'm happy to have you here. Welcome, Oliver Koch.
Hi, Max. It's a pleasure also for me being invited to this fantastic new podcast. We know each other a little bit. You have worked for a bit already in the Commission, so all the more it's interesting to see you back here and your interesting podcast. I hope it's a good experience from the machine room of where all this energy law comes from.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. So I decided to not work for the EU Commission. I never applied after my stay in your unit. How did you come to work at the EU Commission?
So it was like you start with European law at that time. I just found it very interesting and a fantastic idea against fragmentation in the world, the European movement. It was in the 90s. I worked at the university on a European law chair for quite a while. And then The way is either you had to stay at the university like it happened to you, or you go to practice, and the classic entry then is, unfortunately, there's not a lot of market for fundamental freedom lawyers and all what we did at university, but for competition law is European law to a large extent and super exciting, so I became a competition lawyer at a big law firm. And then, as it happens, you do a concours, a competition, you enter the European Commission, and indeed, I worked for 10 years in DG Competition first on European competition law and changed then to the market department of DG Energy, our energy ministry here, and that's where I am in the most interesting world and job in the world, Max, so I have to still try to convince you.
Or maybe
we can
fight
who has the better job here.
Maybe some of our listeners as well to consider a Blue Book traineeship or other opportunities to get to know the Commission. But maybe, Lea, let's start with some of the basics. What is the European Commission? And why is it important for European energy law?
Yeah, I mean, the European Commission is essentially the executive arm of the European Union. If you wish, the government, we are structured in different ministries, like every government on the territories. And here in DG Energy, you sit in the Energy Ministry, where we design and do energy policy under the supervision, because, of course, like every government, we follow what the parliament, the elected members of parliament, and the parties tell us to do. Next election is ahead, so we will see what we have to do in the next 5 years. And we work a lot with the member states who are sitting just 200 meters from here in the council building and try to convince us to do what they want to do.
So there's one directorate general purely focusing on energy law that also shows that the energy sector is an important branch in EU policy, in EU politics, so to say. Why is there such specific department? Why are there so many people working for energy legislation in the energy sector?
It's quite a recent department, actually. So the energy, DG Energy, you see here, only exists since 2009. So that's really not so long. Energy policy as a policy is quite young. It was the 2009, the Lisbon Treaty process, where we had our own chapter, finally, in energy policy. On the other hand, the whole thing started in, 1951 with a treaty on coal already. So the coal and steel treaty was certainly about energy and energy dominance. The whole purpose was that Germany doesn't get dominant again with kind of blackmailing others with coal and having unfair coal access. So in between, energy policy was, I would say, quite kind of dormant, and it was discovered on the one hand with liberalization idea of energy policy, and on the other hand with ideas to make energy greener, and with some energy crisis. We had already in 2006 and 2009 some supply crisis. Ukraine routes were stopped between Russia and Ukraine. The conflicts happened, and that race was giving the people the idea that maybe we need a proper ministry for energy. And that's why in 2009 we finally created the ministry. Before, there was already some energy policy in other direct generals, transport and energy, and hidden in other policies.
And so DG Ener, DG Energy, is working with secondary law, with the specific energy market regulation, whereas other departments also have conflicts or also enforce EU rules in energy markets. Is that correct to say it this way?
I would even say we're not working with secondary law. We're actually planning, drafting, and developing it. We are writing the law. That's the fascinating thing. And then, of course, once it's adopted, once we could convince Parliament and Council to adopt something similar, at least, we enforce it. So that's our job, and we do this indeed with a lot of contacts with other DGs. So my old DG, DG Competition, is certainly prime example. State aid law, energy state aid, so Germany will finance 20 gigawatt of new gas power plants. I mean, that's a subsidy. They give money to market players, and that's something where DG Competition has a word, and DG Enna will have a word. We work in teams together. I sit with DG Trade on litigation cases against Gazprom because they sue us for 10 billion because we stopped the Nord Stream pipeline. We sit with DG Grow on industrial policy. How can we have more green energy policy and green production in Europe? We sit with really many other DGs almost on a daily basis, which is quite interesting.
So DG Competition, for example, can enforce Article 101, Article 102, so really core competition law rules, whereas DG Grow, so the DG on internal market, industry, entrepreneurship, and SMEs, is also enforcing the fundamental freedoms in the energy sector.
That's what you think. In reality, all this is delegated. We always try to convince DG Grow to enforce the fundamental freedoms. If there's an energy fundamental freedom case, we have just one on the table, I can tell you. It was public, I think. Germany imposes a gas tariff on other cross-border points, limiting free flow of gas. That's a classic cross-border case, if you wish. And that's done here inside. So my team is writing now to Germany why this is not a good idea and why we think things should maybe change. We have the discussions, we call the ministry, we sit with them. But of course, we inform also other departments if this happens. So that's indeed inside. DG Grow policy, if you wish, we had a net zero industrial act that's meant to make sure that we have enough own resources for solar panels, for windmills and other key products for the Green Deal. That's a bit industrial policy where we were co-drafting this Net Zero Industrial Act with them, by way of an example. So there are manyfold different overlaps with the other DGs there.
So it's not that DG Grow is purely looking at the primary law and DG Energy.
Not at all. DG Grow is looking at law. Industrial policy. They are Thierry Breton, and they look at how we can save the European industry.
And so the two main pillars of current energy politics, of current energy policy in the past years, can probably be named as the European Green Deal from the 11th December of 2019 and also the Repower EU plan of 18th May 2022. Are those two pillars, as I call them, still important for your daily work now? And maybe can you elaborate a little bit on those two strategies?
I mean, certainly they are. They have even an, I would say, overwhelming role for the Commission. On the one hand, these are buzzwords. Yeah, we have to use them in all speeches, recitals, and projects we do. But of course, if you take the Green Deal, that was really a deliberate policy choice and a policy project. So there was the feeling in 2018-19, Greta Thunberg was on the streets. People had the feeling we need really to push the Green Deal now. And a conservative president, Ursula von der Leyen, is a conservative. She's not a Green. She said, okay, that's now my priority, and we are her team. And she told us, listen, guys, you have to design now something that is not energy policy in this house here, but that is all-encompassing for the whole Commission, all DGs, yeah, DG Agriculture, DG Grow, even DG Comp, all the others. You have to make the Green Deal your priority. I want to see from you new legislative proposals. How do we really make it happen? How can we get more ambitious climate targets? How can we have more renewables in the system? How can we not only make the energy production greener, but also agriculture and industry? So DG Grow worked on the Green Deal. DG Agriculture worked on the Green Deal. Everybody with their own legal proposals, a huge package packed together. And that was the new approach. I mean, we did energy policy for quite a while, and that was what we used to do. And with the Green Deal, what happened is really that it was the number one policy objective suddenly also of almost all other DGs.
And it set out the main goal of climate neutrality.
Climate neutrality 2050 is the goal. And then we have interim targets in 2030, quite ambitious one to get CO2 free in a guaranteed manner, because, of course, it's easy to say in 2050 we will do something. The Green Deal actually sets very concrete measures in place. And that's the fascinating thing. So, I mean, it's easy for a politician to say we will be climate neutral in 2050. But what the packages, the Fit for 55 CO2 reduction package was a huge package of 80 pieces of legislation. What it does is really to go step by step. And that led, of course, to quite tricky discussions on how to insulate houses. Because if you want to do this, you have at one point to start insulating your houses. And I think the German heat pump discussions and discussions on insulating old buildings in France and other countries showed it's a different thing just to agree on a nice goal. Or now what we've done with the Green Deal to put into place legislation that actually says you have certain targets. Yeah, from phasing out combustion engines for cars to getting rid of your gas boiler one day, insulating your house. So that's the concrete legal measures we put in place now. And that was quite fascinating and quite important, but also quite contentious, as you can see.
So Fit for 55 kind of aligning EU policy in all areas with the ambitious goals of the Green Deal.
That's the new thing. That's really because, I mean, we also thought first, okay, Green Deal, before it was the energy union or decarbonization or whatever you call it. But the Green Deal is really, it of course alludes to the New Deal, yeah, the New Deal in the 30s, where really the whole economy was meant to get a boost. Also, the Green Deal was meant as a project also to really kickstart the industry. It was indeed a growth plan, and the idea was also to take the citizens to ensure that it's not just costly and people will lose job, but that new industry is created. That's why we have also this industrial policy component in it, and that is quite important for the entire construction.
So all those ambitious goals, and then there was Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, there was a bit of drama because we're in the middle of the 55 project, by the way, with a huge bunch of ongoing legislation, all to really make the Green Deal happen. And then in 22, I was on holidays with my kids and I had to interrupt it and essentially draft a storage regulation over 3 days somewhere in a cabin via internet, because instead of decarbonization laws, what we needed was to cope with the situation that we depended in Europe to a huge extent on Russian gas. So, I mean, I think for whole Europe, it was almost 40%. Big countries, Germany, 55%. Some Eastern countries still almost entirely dependent on Russian gas. And suddenly you realize that's your enemy. You're in war with this country, at least in an economic war.
And energy is used as a weapon by this enemy.
That's what the Commission had said 10 years before already. Let's be prudent. Let's not get too dependent. We had long fights with member states about having regulation for Russian imports. Yeah, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, we wanted to have it regulated precisely to prevent risks of dependence. We have argued for diversification. But of course, in the 10 years before, people could never imagine that things like a Russian supply interruption would ever happen. They said even in the Cold War, Russian gas was always safe. So what happened was really a real drama. And I can tell you internally, we had crisis meeting like in a crisis you may imagine from a thriller, because we realized really that, I mean, I shouldn't say it, but Russia had us really by the balls, if you wish. Yeah. So the industrial production of Europe hinges on energy. And if you cut only 20% of energy, only 10%, prices explode. That's what happened. Energy prices went from 30 to 350 euros within half a year. In August 22, the price for gas was 350 euros. with impact on inflation, with impact on employment, but also with the actual risk. And that's what maybe was not so clear outside. It was not only an uncomfortable political situation, it was a real crisis for the industry and for citizens, because if in Europe, in a cold winter, you don't have gas, you're in a quite a mess. And that's really, it doesn't only mean that you have to plug off Renault and Volkswagen, because somebody then has to cut the energy if there's not enough. It actually means that you have to cater that your hospitals are running. You have to see who gets the gas in times of scarcity. And that's, of course, an idea we never had imagined to really activate. We had some security of supply legislation, but the idea that we have to talk about rationing of gas in the member states was quite a novel situation, and it was, of course, very interesting, but it was a dramatic situation. What saved us was two warm winters. This winter was warm, the last winter was warm, so we didn't have to burn so much gas. Of course, we adopted all kinds of gas rationing legislation. 15% less gas was decided and agreed upon in some crisis legislation that was then very quickly adopted, commitments to save gas. But in reality, that was, from a legal point of view, of course, a very fascinating situation, because if you have 27 member states, some have more gas, some have LNG. Spain was in a quite comfortable situation. They had plenty of LNG terminals. Germany,
liquefied natural gas.
Liquefied natural gas terminals. Where the ships come, you don't depend on pipeline. Other countries were totally dependent on pipeline gas. They were back to the wall. And of course, a situation, then the discussion on solidarity comes up. Yeah, and the idea is, how do we share gas if Europe doesn't have enough gas? Yeah, will every country just say, I maximize my supplies because I have to protect my citizens? Or are we ready to share in times of crisis? And that's a fascinating, very European discussion. And we developed rules and legislation that indeed imposed such sharing obligations. But that was quite an interesting discussion, as you can imagine, because that the discussions with member states were very tough. The readiness to share is, of course, not always there. In a nutshell, I must still say, with hindsight, it was remarkable that, I mean, Europe did not break up. We could agree on quickly agreed legislation to share energy, to reduce gas consumption, to also intervene in price, or let's say not intervene in pricing, but prevent extreme price hikes, all very sensitive policies. And within a few weeks, we were sitting in crisis mode with member states and adopted quite a bunch of crisis legislation to react to this unexpected development in the mid of our nice Green Deal term. And that was the one thing. So we had a series of crisis, 6-7 quick legal acts, from faster permitting to the joint purchasing of gas to exchange of energy and gas in times of scarcity. But we also did then what you mentioned, the repower strategy immediately after the war started.
Kind of the initial response by the European Commission to the aggression.
Exactly. But it came in an end. I mean, the initial response, I mean, you maybe didn't see, the initial response was really to say we need quickly some rules. Like in COVID, you also had, of course, new legislation to jointly purchase vaccines. We did the same for gas and for saving gas. But yes, there was also a strategy then to speed up, also with money and with a change of policy, the diversification of gas.
And also to not give, to ensure security of supply, but also not giving up on the decarbonization goals, the climate neutrality goals.
Because, I mean, the first calls was after the war was, okay, you cancel the Green Deal, now all hands on deck, we need to save energy, we put on our diesel generators, and we need every molecule of energy and of gas everywhere, so forget about the Green Deal. Our response was quite the opposite, of course. And you see, Germany had to put on to put on their coal-fired power plants to survive in a situation where gas didn't flow. So there were, of course, developments that were not what we had in mind with the Green Deal. But overall, we managed to get a boost for renewable energy, for instance, because the nice thing about windmills and solar panels is they don't have a plug to Russia. They cannot be stopped by a Russian president, and they are an insurance against energy security problems. So what was done with the help also of a lot of money that was made available is to give Bulgaria, Romania the chance to kickstart their energy transformation from pipeline gas to solar and wind projects. And massive investments of solar and wind projects happened in Europe, and I think it's really impressive also what has happened also in the last year in terms of solar and wind investments. So that was the idea to then say, okay, let's use the opportunity not to go back to coal, but to really then kickstart the climate transition, get even a more ambitious goals to get rid of gas because we saw it's toxic, and to organize the transformation to renewables.
And also new energy technologies were emphasized as a key lever for the energy transition, such as hydrogen.
Of course. I mean, the investment into hydrogen, that was a project before. We were working on a big package for legislation for this new evolving market, hydrogen, which is supposed to replace, indeed, the gas we are using. And hydrogen, we all love it. You burn it, you have water, and not CO2. It's of course, this became much more urgent now. So we have also boosted this project. The hydrogen legislation is now almost adopted. It's in the final phases. The member states agreed on it. We will have a whole set of legislation and a whole set of support measures for a backbone network of hydrogen, for having a minimum amount of hydrogen production in Europe, and also all this with the necessary financial support. So there was certainly also a kickstart for the hydrogen transformation.
So that is all the perspective of the European Commission. What other important actors do you want to mention? Or you also already mentioned that you're working together with many other, with the member states, with the ministries of the member states. What about third countries? What about other institutions within Europe?
That's a super important part. But I mean, the first thing you said is, of course, completely wrong. So, I mean, the Commission is the slave of the Council and the Parliament. We do what they say. Yeah, we just make humble proposals. If you look what we have proposed and what comes out of the machine is very, very different. Yeah, we propose renewables target and they say, no, that's too ambitious. We propose market measures and they say, no, we want rather other things. We want subsidies. Sometimes we can manage to convince Council and Parliament that this is not a good idea, but they have the power. So the Green Deal ultimately is a Council and Parliament project. We develop ideas, we give it a label maybe, but the power in the European Union is with the Council and the Member State. They do the legislation. And I say this because we have elections ahead, and I can just say if you elect the wrong persons, you get the wrong policy. Whatever we will want to do in this house here in DG Energy will depend on who will be elected next year. So that's
so
my first comment.
Green Deal was not the idea of Ursula von der Leyen.
It was not the idea of Ursula von der Leyen without an electorate that had really supported this policy stream and a very strong kind of green part in the house and a full support of even the conservatives for this policy stream. This would not have happened. And it remains to be seen whether the next election will give so much support for the Green Deal as the last elections did. And my personal bet is this will not be the case, and we will have to reshape our policies. And that's not a Commission choice. This is the choice of the European citizens, who adapt their policy preferences also from time to time, also when it comes to energy. And the affordability of energy has probably become a bit more of an issue than it used to be 5 years ago. So that's on who has the power. I mean, it sounds all nice what the Commission does, but we're just an executive arm of policy choices that essentially come from your audience, hopefully, if they go
Parliament,
voting.
The Parliament and the Council are the main
Council.
Players.
They decide on the law. They can rewrite all our proposals, and they only what they adopt becomes law. So the center of power, I wouldn't underestimate it, is also very much with the Parliament today. And they have a lot of power and they use it. They redraft our laws. They introduce different provisions than we had in mind. And especially when it comes to, is it repower? Is it Green Deal? Or is it market? Or is it maybe industry in the next commission? Or is it even cutting back the Green Deal? That's decided by the voters and the parliament that we will have in the next 5 years.
You mentioned affordability as something that gains importance. But if you look, for example, in the primary law in the treaties, you see security of supply as an energy
policy goal. You see energy efficiency as an energy policy goal, but you don't see affordability.
I see affordability. It's the number one of energy policy. It started with it because the energy policy in the EU, the recent one after the coal community, started with market liberalization. And the only reason why we have competition or market policy is that consumers have a better deal if their suppliers compete. They get a better price and a better product if you organize competition. That's the starting point of all market and competition policy. So affordability is competition and market policy. That was at the very beginning in the late 90s when we created, instead of state monopolies where you had a fixed state regulated price, a system where suddenly energy companies could compete. Yeah, they could use the pipelines, although it was a monopoly with third-party access, and fantastically we had a market. And that brought down prices quite significantly, if you look at it, and created choice, and was clearly a super step. So affordability, in our understanding, is market policy. So that's the policy arm that we try to organize. The problem is a market can be very efficient and bring your prices down by competing suppliers, but they will not necessarily deliver the type of energy you want. Yeah, maybe they want to buy Russian gas. If you tell them you cannot buy Russian gas, prices will increase. If you tell them you have to buy hydrogen, prices will increase. And there the affordability is influenced by state interventions for security policy or for decarbonization policies. And that's the conflict we are dealing with, and politicians and citizens have to deal with. What's your choice? Do you want to push the Green Deal, and are you ready to pay a bit more for it? Do you want to have the perfect security of supply insurance? This will cost a bit. Do you want just the lowest price? Our answer is very easy. We say we want to reconcile all three things, affordable prices, clean energy, and secure energy. And our main mantra is, how do we achieve it? We cooperate. Yeah? We share our energy. That's the cheapest. We still organize a market. We organize security of supply by relying also on others, by sharing the energy and not all building backup plants, coal backup plants, which would pollute the world, but use the energy from the neighbor. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing using energy from the neighbor, as it's sometimes presented. And the same for decarbonization. Of course, if you share energy, it's much cleaner than if you organize the transition at a local or national level. So that's essentially the answer we have. Affordability is important, but it is strongly affected by other policy goals.
And all those new regulations, they do not lead to a turning point in the liberalization process.
I hope not. I mean, they strongly influence the liberalization process. And to give you an example, we just had an interesting report from the German Court of Auditors on energy policy, and they say, listen, with all respect for your transition wishes, you need to think of the costs of the energy transition and also of the functioning of the price signal. In Germany, between 50 and 75% of the price is energy price for customers is state regulated. So if we want a price that reacts to the market, that's only 25% of the remaining price. So that's the risk if you are too ambitious with your state interventions, subsidies, the whatever, renewable surcharge. It's wonderful. You finance windmills. But if you put it on the energy price, that won't react anymore to market signals. If you finance grid expansion just through the energy price, it will mean that also this is a state-regulated price. It will not react to demand and supply. So these state interventions are indeed in conflict with the idea of prices that signal scarcity and demand and supply, which is important for a good energy market and brings prices down. So there is steady tensions, and we have to see if we have too much state interventions, maybe from time to time, to cut it back to bring a bit more market signals to the benefit of consumers.
So all those state interventions, all these new developments in energy law on the European level, they are formally initiated by the European Commission. In the process, the Parliament and the Council are the main actors. But still, the Commission also advises Parliament in Council and Council in the process of enacting energy law. Do you want to maybe also elaborate a little bit more on the role of the European Commission in this legislative process?
I can do this, but I would strongly reject the statement that the European Commission designs the state intervention. And that's, for me, it's very important for the understanding of energy law. Energy law is not an exclusive EU competence. I would even say we are often on the sidelines. Energy policy is a hugely important national policy. Germany has a big discussion and a huge acquis, so a whole bunch of energy legislation. Yeah, ours comes on top. Of course, there's primacy of energy law, but when I talked about state interventions, these state interventions are national state interventions. Germany has a certain model to finance subsidies. In Netherlands, they put a lot of money to finance solar panels, and it's a completely different model. And it also has some problems with markets. Greece has a different model. So the interventions, the coordination of national state intervention is what I meant. I hope the state interventions do not come from us. What we try to do is that we have legislation that coordinates and keeps the state interventions in check. But indeed, we have a layer that comes on top of national legislation, and the beauty of it is that it has primacy of European law. So if member states agree to do something, whatever, to create an independent regulator at European level, they are indeed obliged to change their national law. Yeah, we just took some member states to court and said, listen, guys, you agreed to have an independent regulator, but we see there's all kinds of legislation in place that imposes what they should do. Yeah, abolish it. So that's what happens with European energy law. And indeed, there's a duality. There is still European and national law. But if they concern the same things, EU energy prevails. So, and how is the machine working that cooks up this energy legislation? So, it's quite simple. We just designed the recipe, if you wish. So we are asked after an election, and it will happen now in the next summer elections, that the new commission will come to us and write us a paper. Please do the following on energy policy in the next 5 years. Develop legislation on, I don't know, energy investments, further decarbonization, getting market signals back, better enforcement. I don't know what will happen. And then we go, and we are already doing this in reality. In this house, you will see many working groups brainstorming on future legislation. So we will draft and have ideas for future legislation. We make proposals for new legislation, and this will happen then after the next election. So the legislative proposals, and that's specificity of the EU process, they come exclusively from the Commission in practice. However, of course, in reality, the Parliament and the Council, if they meet, and they do meet, if they say, you should do whatever, joint gas purchasing, we will do it in practice. So there is also a policy, it's strong policy steer. And the idea that the Commission can just sit on their own policies with a monopoly for the legislative proposals is just not realistic. So in reality, member states and Parliament signal to us what they would like to see. The Parliament can even, under certain conditions, indeed, in the new treaty, force us to put certain things on the agenda and into legislative proposals. So yes, we do formally have the legislative monopoly. We write all the legislative proposals. But first, this is on the mandate of the member states, on the political mandate. And second, you would be surprised how often member states, even in the drafting phase, visit us, because we consult on our drafts and they give us already input and say, if you write this, we won't vote for it, so you better remove it. So we cannot go completely crazy with our proposals. And we draft it in strong consultation and contact with Parliament and member states, and they comment already on the draft. So once we have agreed on how it should like, with, in the ideal world, lots of impact assessments and consultations and political discussions, we make a legal proposal that is published, and that then goes indeed to the legislative negotiation and adoption process, where the Council first, all the member states, discuss the proposal. They have to agree, 27 member states, in rounds. They would take the text, the respective presidency would make proposals to change it. So if Hungary says, I don't like the idea of energy sharing, or Germany says, I don't like the idea of opening my electricity borders, or if Spain says, I want more connection to France, they will write some sentences in. At the same time, the Parliament sits and they write their own counter proposal. And they may say, I want to do more for the citizens and I want to stop Russian gas. And that's what they did in the last package. So we will have two different proposals from the council at the end and the parliament, because they have to agree then on a common approach from the council and also on a parliament position on the legislative text. So,
and this agreement is reached in this so-called trilogue?
That's so. First, we have, after a few months, usually the respective positions, which can be quite nasty between member states and the parliament, where we are already in a bit. So we follow the council discussions and try to at least technically advise what's happening, to a lesser extent also in the parliament. And then we see we have two conflicting texts, what happens, and then indeed it comes to the showdown, the famous trilogue, so tripartite, commission, the council and the parliament sit in a room here in the council in Brussels or in the parliament in Brussels or in Strasbourg, starting at 8 in the evening, going until 5 o'clock in the morning, and discussing compromises between the two different positions. And the parliament would say, okay, I swallow your limitation of the market if you give me a prohibition of Russian gas. And that discussion, they will listen to us. We will say we don't like it, but they will then, in many cases, also kindly disregard us and say that's a political issue and we take note what the commission says. We have no whatsoever role in the trilogues. We're just sitting, listening and moderating, but the decisions are between council and parliament, and they will agree in the morning somewhere at 5 o'clock on a final text. This is what has happened now with the gas and hydrogen package, with the market design electricity package, with the net zero package, with the just this week adopted buildings insulation directive. So that's the typical cycle: commission proposal, discussions within parliament, within council, and then the final negotiation round, agreement on the final text. And then, of course, there's a bit of fine-tuning at the end.
Also language-wise, because negotiations take place in English.
We negotiate an English text, and then, of course, the really ambitious countries are very diligent to try to seek in their national language version to have maybe a slightly favorable translation. Because legally, all versions are authentic. So if you interpret, if you have a case in court, I was just yesterday confronted with a case where the French translation is completely different from the German and English translation, and very favorable for the party that sues the commission. So we have to explain what happened, because they say, okay, what you see from the French version, what really was meant. So you have to be very careful even in this phase. That's true.
So two very important legislative provisions for energy regulation are Article 194 TFEU, since the Treaty of Lisbon, in primary law. What is the difference between those two provisions? Why do you base one law on Article 194 and other legal acts on Article 122?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I had no clue what Article 122 is. Yeah, I was on holidays. I got a call from my DG, from my boss, so to say, and said, Oliver, write a 122 to stabilize the situation. And I said, what the hell is a 122? It turned out the 122 is a type of crisis regulation that had been used in the COVID legislation and oftentimes before. Yeah, fascinatingly, the oil stocks directive. Some may know it. Yeah, the obligation to save oil, to stock oil from the 70s crisis is based on the 122 crisis council regulation. So the 122 is a legal instrument that allows in a severe crisis to circumvent, if you wish, the wonderful legislative procedure we've just described, where elected members of parliament have the final say on the laws. It allows in an acute crisis, and 122 says, for instance, for the supply of energy, if there's really a risk for the supply of energy, then we can take exceptional measures, and the council can indeed decide on appropriate measures. And that means the council can not only say we should do this and this, they can adopt regulations, council regulations, on the legal basis of Article 122. Fascinating. And that has the beauty, pragmatically, that, of course, the council agreement with 27 member states takes a bit of time, but it is much less complex and much faster than a complete legislative process. A complete legislative process can take up to 2 to 3 years if you take it according to the rule book. Yeah, from proposals, discussions, consultations, common positions, trilogues. So the 1 to 2, it was clear we need now to save gas within weeks. We need legal proposals within weeks. And that meant we have to go for 1 to 2 proposal in certain cases. So 1 to 2 means only council, parliament has to watch from the side. They are kindly informed, but have no say on all this. As you can imagine, the parliament was not very happy about it. So we had topics on the agenda. It was clear we will run out of gas if we don't do anything. So we need to make sure that we save gas. So demand reduction regulation was necessary. We need to have better solidarity. If one country has gas, the other doesn't have gas. And we needed to make clear that storage is filled. At that time, Gazprom owned the German storages and they were all empty for surprising reason. You can ask yourself why. So we also need to do a storage regulation to make sure that storages are filled and that at least we are sure they're not Russian owned. And if they are Russian owned, at least we can do something. So, and then, of course, we were discussing what to use. We have two alternative legal bases. One is the 194 basis you mentioned. That means full-fledged procedure, Parliament Council. Or 1-2. And actually for the storage, we got the informal signal from the parliament. And there was Mr. Buzik, a Polish energy expert and really a very nice member of parliament who has long chaired the energy committee and was responsible for this policy file. He said, listen, commission, council, we offer you to have the speediest ever adoption of a full-fledged legislation. We will not ask for three trilogues. We offer you one trilogue. We offer you to be very pragmatic, but please let us adopt this storage regulation as a full-fledged legislative procedure. And that's what we did. We started, as I said, on the holidays. We drafted very quickly a storage legislation. We were sitting already with the members of parliament and with the council. And within 6 weeks, essentially, we managed to have in two sessions with the council discussions on this and also in one trilogue an agreement on a storage regulation that was finally adopted, I think, in May. So I think that was probably the fastest ever full-fledged legislative proposal and procedure that led to a full-fledged parliament and council regulation. It was easy for storage because that was quite technically easy piece of legislation. It just said all member states have to fill the storage by November by X percent. For the other acts, the decision was not to go for parliament regulation, but for a council regulation, an emergency regulation, if you wish, because they were technically much more complex and it was decided it would just take too much time. We need to have an efficient limitation of gas demand. We need to have solidarity rules now. And I wouldn't say there was a tacit agreement by the parliament. They didn't like it very much and they wrote some papers that they would like to see in future less use of this instrument. But I mean, the parliament didn't sue us. Yeah, the parliament, I think, had some comprehension. And what we did then over time, now we transformed the emergency regulations into permanent legislation. So the current gas package has most of the elements of the crisis legislation in. We have joint purchasing. We have clauses against Russian gas in certain situations. We have solidarity rules in the permitting emergency regulation, which lifted permitting rules for wind and solar to boost the repower strategy and to have very fast installation of wind and solar panels, was lifted to the renewables directive, which was also revised now. So I would say it was an intermediate step, this exceptional use of 1-2, sidestepping democratic elements like the parliament. So it is probably legitimate. It's in court. We have a case, Poland and some other cases who sue the commission and the council, or in this case it's the council because it's a council regulation, for using this instrument. And we will see if the court ultimately endorses sidestepping the parliament in crisis situations, or if the court may say do the procedure differently. We don't know. It's an interesting legal question.
So shifting out of the energy crisis, what are the current challenges for the European Commission in energy policy?
Well, the current challenge is probably the main challenge is to find the right balance between affordability and the necessary energy transition, because we have seen that there's a limit to the acceptance also in the population from the yellow vests to protests against recent Green Deal measures and the agriculture, the nature and restoration law that was at stake when recently the farmers put the streets on fire was taken back as a reaction to very strong resistance in the population. So to find a way to pursue the Green Deal strategy and the security of supply strategy in a manner that is not leading to industrial problems and not leading to energy poverty is and remains a challenge. And that's where we are developing strategies now, from investment policy, building new alliances for energy supply with others, from strengthening markets again, where we maybe have neglected them. But the choice for you guys. So you go to election, and if you say, I want a party that denies the climate change, we will do a different policy in the next 5 years. Then if you all go and vote for parties that say we in principle want to pursue this policy. So I cannot predict what our future policy priorities are. That's for you to decide.
Thank you so much for showing us or giving us some insights in your expertise, Oliver.
Thanks to you, Max, and I hope we encourage at least some in the audience to opt for the commission and not for academics, because we need smart people here also in ours in the future. Thanks to you.
The first season of the Energy Law podcast was made possible with funds of the Dutch Starter Grant Program, awarded by Tilburg University for my project, Transformation Processes in European and National Economic Law, Energy Law as Law of Socio-Technical Change. A special thanks for production support goes out to Mark Ohrendorf from Irgendwas mit Recht.